I'm going to go ahead and introduce Professor Earhart. He's truly a speaker who needs no introduction, as you all have his book on your bookshelf, and you probably use it regularly. He is a professor at the Florida State University and has received a number of awards and distinctions in that capacity. His evidence book is used widely throughout the country, and we're very excited to have him here today to talk about hearsay issues. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Professor Earhart.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be with you today. When I received the invitation to do this, I was mulling over a little bit whether to do it, and had dinner one evening a couple months ago probably with my wife and Mary Hopping. Mary Hopping was in the Tallahassee office guardian ad litem for a long time, and my wife was a guardian ad litem in Franklin County. So I realized after that dinner that I wanted to do this, and I appreciate the opportunity to do so. What I'm going to do, I'm going to talk about the hearsay issues that I think would come up most frequently with you. What is hearsay, four or five hearsay exceptions, and then talk some about confrontation, which I think comes up in termination of parental rights proceedings. I guess the beginning point with any hearsay is the definition of hearsay. And Florida has the traditional definition of hearsay. Hearsay is an out-of-court statement offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. And unless both parts of that definition are present, a statement is not hearsay. Now, the Florida cases, and in my materials, I'm not going to repeat the citations, but we'll speak about case names. The Florida cases are fairly clear that any statement made by anybody outside the courtroom is an out-of-court statement for the purposes of the definition of hearsay, including a witness who testifies at trial. A witness may not quote himself or herself, or an out-of-court statement to, for example, a police officer is still hearsay, even if that witness testifies. Now, one of the things that's happened in the past few years is that counsel has become aware of that and has become what I would say creative about trying to avoid that part of the hearsay definition. For example, in the Cedillo case, which I've got in the second page of my outline, a criminal case where the officer testified that after interviewing the witnesses, he determined the defendant was a suspect. And the objection was that was hearsay. The response was, no, it's not, because we didn't ask the officer what the witnesses told him. And what the fourth DCA said and what the Florida cases have said is, when the inescapable inference from the testimony of the witness is that other witnesses have made an out-of-court statement, it is hearsay if it's offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. Now, if you look at the Farinacci case, I guess, on page 3, that was the prosecution for lewd and lascivious molestation. And what the prosecutor in that case did was to call the detective and rather ask the detective what the child said, was ask the detective to demonstrate the manner in which the victim said the defendant abused him. Objection, hearsay. No, it's not hearsay because we're not offering the testimony of the out-of-court statement of the victim. And the fourth DCA said, no, it is hearsay because the inescapable inference from that testimony described the manner in which the victim said the defendant abused him clearly is that the victim made these out-of-court statements. All right, out-of-court statement, offered to prove the truth of the matter asserted. unless it is offered to prove the truth of the out-of-court statement. Truth of what was said out of court, it is not hearsay. Well, officer, why were you dispatched? Child protection team. Why did you get involved in this case? Well, we had a report that, all right, out of court statement, we had a report that, is it offered to prove the truth? No, we're not offering it to prove the truth of the matter asserted. We're offering it to prove why the child protection team investigated. We're offering it to show why the officer arrested the defendant. Hearsay exceptions. Spontaneous statements, 8031. Statements made while the declarant is perceiving an event, which statements describe the event while it is occurring or immediately thereafter. The rationale for reliability is the spontaneous nature of a statement that is contemporaneous with an event. The DePerevine case from the Supreme Court says there is no requirement for a startling event or condition, like there is for an excited utterance. Now, the problem with children is, or in child abuse cases, I doubt this exception hardly ever applies because the statement has to be made at the time of the abusive act. And I would guess, and it's only a guess on my part, as in Jano, that these statements would be made sometime after the abusive act occurred and therefore wouldn't qualify under 8031. Excited utterances. Your Honor, excited utterances. Statements made while the declarant, the child, is in an excited or stressful state. Which statements concern the event which caused that excited or stressful state? All right, the rationale obviously is that the stressful and excited state of mind is sufficient indication of an absence of intent to make a false statement, and the statement is reliable. The problem with excited utterances, I think, in your cases, is that Hutchinson and Jano recognized. Hutchinson is a Florida Supreme Court decision. It was a murder victim, and the victim called a friend the evening the victim was killed to say that 30 minutes ago she just had a big fight with the defendant. All right, and clearly the victim, the declarant at the time she made the statement, was in an excited or stressful state. What the Supreme Court said in Hutchinson was what they had earlier said in Jano about child abuse, and that is that when the statement is made sometime after the startling event, there has to be affirmative evidence that the excited or stressful state of mind never left the declarant, so that the declarant did not have an opportunity to engage in reflective thought. So that a statement made by a child, an hour, a day, a week, even after the abusive act, even though the child was excited, upset, and emotional at the time he or she made the statement, wouldn't be admissible under 8032 in all probability, unless, I don't know much about these cases, fortunately, but unless there was affirmative evidence that excited, stressful state never left the child from the time of the abusive act until the time the statement was made. So I think normally or usually or generally 8031 and 8032 won't be applicable to statements made by children who are abuse victims. However, 8034 may well be applicable. Statements made for the purpose of medical diagnosis and treatment. Statements made for the purpose of medical diagnosis and treatment relating to present symptoms or past symptoms have reliability because the declarant knows that diagnosis or treatment is dependent on the patient's statements. Under 8034, statements of general causation of the illness, of the symptom, of the disease are admissible if they're reasonably pertinent to medical diagnosis and treatment. For example, an automobile accident case, my back hurts. It started hurting when I was involved in an automobile accident. All right, the statement, it started hurting when I was involved in an automobile accident, would be admissible under 8034 to prove that that was the cause of the injury. But statements of fault are not admissible under 8034 because they're not reasonably pertinent to medical diagnosis or treatment. In other words, I hurt my back in an automobile accident when an 18-wheeler ran a red light. When an 18-wheeler ran a red light is a statement of fault that has no bearing on medical diagnosis and treatment. Now, why that's relevant is what the Florida Supreme Court in Jones said a number of years ago was that in child abuse cases, under 8034, statements of the victim, of the child, could be admissible to medical personnel, to child protection team folks, insofar as they related to I was abused, and this is the way the abusive act occurred, but the statements of the child identifying the defendant or the parent as the abuser were not admissible under 8034 because they were statements of fault. And what the Florida Supreme Court said was, rather than admitting them under 8034, the appropriate way for those to be admitted is under 803.23, the child abuse victim exception, which you all are familiar with. And what the child abuse victim exception requires is that we have a out-of-court statement by a child abuse victim who is 11 or less when the court makes a case-specific finding. This statement is reliable because a case-specific finding of reliability, and either the child testifies at the trial or hearing or is unable to testify, the demonstration of unavailability, and if unavailable, there must be evidence to corroborate that the abusive act occurred. The case-specific finding reliability, and either the child testifies, and if the child doesn't testify, showing that the child is unavailable, and there's corroboration that the abusive act occurred. All right, number of issues. 11 or less when? At the time of the statement or the time of trial? Contreras from the Florida Supreme Court, the time the statement was made. It doesn't make any difference how old the child is at the time of the trial or hearing. It's the time of the statement. All right. I think in your cases there is a substantial problem here with family law rule 12.407 that you all are aware of, and that's on page 5 of my materials, which says that a minor child can't be deposed or brought into court to appear as a witness without prior order of the court based on good cause unless it's an emergency. Well, children are then unavailable, generally. If children are unavailable because of family law rule 12.407, their statements are not admissible under 803.23 unless there is corroboration that the abusive act occurred. All right, what is corroboration? Well, we don't know for sure, but on page 5 there, I've got two cases. One is the Gallicani case from the 4th DCA, which is that evidence of simply opportunity to abuse is not sufficient to corroborate to confirm that the charged offense occurred. In the RU against the DCF case, what was offered to cooperate was other hearsay statements of the child. That obviously this statement is true and we're to corroborate that the abusive act occurred, we're going to offer other hearsay statements of the child. And the fourth ECA said no, that the corroborating evidence must be derived from a source other than the child victim's own statements. So the evidence may clearly be admissible, and I would assume that frequently is the hearsay exception that is going to be relied on to admit the out-of-court statements of the child abuse victim. There is another issue that I think is an important issue, and that is, when are records, documents, admissible? There is a significant Florida Supreme Court case from, I guess, 3 years ago now, on the top of page 6, the Israel case, that laid out the requirements for documents to be admitted under the public record exception and the business record exception to the hearsay rule in Florida. And it's a very good, very straightforward opinion. This case involved a letter written by a Department of Corrections employee to a prosecutor relating to the release date of a prisoner. And it was on Department of Corrections letterhead. And it also involved a document from the Department of Corrections. I guess the short of it is that what Israel said, first of all, the business record exception, these documents don't speak for themselves. You have to lay a foundation through the testimony of a witness for a document to be admissible under the business record exception. And it lays out the foundation. It's what's required in that quote I've got there. But most importantly, this decided, I think correctly, that the letter from the Department of Corrections employee did not meet any of the requirements for the business record exception. Nor did the letter meet any of the requirements for the public record exception. So not all letters, not all documents are admissible under either the business or public record exception. One of the problems is the Reichenberg case there on page 6. Under the business record, under the public record exception, the entries must be based on the personal knowledge of an employee of either the business, and the state can be a business, or the agency. And if it is somebody from DCF who's going out and interviewing a witness, and it's a result of the witness interviews, it is the witness who has personal knowledge, not the employee of DCF. And so the reports of the investigators for the child protection team and DCF, which contained witness interviews, were not admissible because they weren't based on the personal knowledge of an agent or employee of the business, and neither were they admissible under the public record exception 8038. I think you all are familiar with the Guardian, what the rules are in Florida about the Guardian ad litem reports, and that is that they are not admissible insofar as they contain witness interviews, because the Guardian ad litem doesn't have any personal knowledge of what the witness is saying. It is the witness who has that personal knowledge. There is an issue that comes up, at least as I understand it, in termination of parental rights. That is a significant and very evolving issue, and that is, what about the ability to confront witnesses? If we're going to allow in, for example, hearsay statements of the child, and the child doesn't testify, and they're admissible under, say, 803.23, the child abuse victim, does the parent have a right to confront witnesses? I think the law is, and you know better than I, but I think the law is that at least in termination of parental rights, the answer is yes. What is the current state of the law on confrontation? Well, I guess 7 years ago, the United States Supreme Court significantly changed the confrontation analysis. And in an opinion written by Justice Scalia, Crawford against Washington, Justice Scalia said that what confrontation was all about was the ability to cross-examine. And you either had to have the ability to cross-examine the witness at trial, or if it was what he dubbed or termed testimonial hearsay. Testimonial hearsay. Then testimonial hearsay was only admissible if there was a showing that the witness was unavailable, and if unavailable, had been subject to cross-examination prior to trial. So if there just was a decision, we don't want to call the child because the child won't be a very good witness. The child would not be unavailable for the purposes of confrontation, and therefore, if it was testimonial hearsay, would not be admissible because no showing of unavailability. All right. I'll go into that in a minute a little more. So the big question was, what does testimonial mean? Because he invented that term. Remember, if the child testifies at trial or the hearing, no problem with confrontation because the child can be cross-examined and the child's out-of-court statements can be admitted. A case called Davis against Washington, which is on page 8, what the court said in Davis against Washington, again, the United States Supreme Court, was that statements are not testimonial if made during the course of interrogation, under circumstances that indicate the primary purpose of the interrogation is to enable the police to assist in an ongoing emergency. But if there's no such emergency and the primary purpose of the interrogation is to establish or prove past events relevant to later criminal prosecution, then they are testimonial. All right. So if there's not an emergency and the primary purpose of the interrogation is to establish or prove past events relevant to a later criminal prosecution, they're testimonial and therefore the confrontation right is invoked. In Lopez, which is down there at the bottom of page 8, we had a victim. And I believe this victim, and I may be wrong, a little bit wrong in my facts. The defendant had shot at the victim's feet to make the victim dance. They called the police 6 to 8 minutes after the crime was reported. The police responded. The victim made an excited utterance. Florida Supreme Court said was that the circumstances indicate there was no emergency at the time the officer talked to the victim, at the time the victim was made, and the primary purpose of the interrogation was to establish or prove past events relevant to later criminal prosecution. All right, what does that mean? That means that under Crawford against Washington, there has to be a showing that the declarant, the victim, was unavailable and had been subject to cross-examination prior to trial. All right, we're going to hold on that for a minute. More to your point, Contreras, and I think most of you are probably familiar with Contreras. Child abuse victim, videotape interview with a child protection team worker. Now, it was done in a shelter with a detective in an adjoining room who could whisper in the ear, electronic ear, of the interviewer. Those statements that the child protection team coordinator were admissible under 803.23. Were they admissible under Crawford? All right. Are they testimonial? If they're testimonial, then unavailability and subject to cross-examination is required. And what the Florida Supreme Court said in contrast was, this kind of an interview by the child protection team is indistinguishable from an ordinary police interrogation and was testimonial. The primary purpose was to investigate whether the crime of sexual abuse had occurred and to establish facts potentially relevant to a later criminal prosecution. Hernandez, statements of the victim to parents and to the nurse. Well, strike that. Statements of both the victim and the parents to the nurse, who is a member of the child protection team, were testimonial. On the other hand, statements made to family and friends. Somerville, Pankow, not made during the course of a police interrogation, not testimonial, not subject to confrontation. All right, if it is testimonial, there's got to be a showing of unavailability before the statement can come in if the witness does not testify. Contreras on page 10 said that a child witness can be unavailable under Crawford due to the mental or emotional harm that testifying can cause. So if there is that showing, and there must be that showing, then of unavailability, then testimonial hearsay, the interview with a child protection team worker, can come in if the child had been subject to cross-examination prior to trial. Well, here's the issue on that. Most of the time, that is lacking. And where we have authority in Florida is on page 11, and that is that what about the fact that a discovery deposition has been taken of the child? Is pretrial discovery an adequate substitute for cross-examination under Contreras? And the Florida Supreme Court in Lopez and Blanton say no. So there actually has to be a hearing with judge, opposing counsel, and so forth, where there is actual cross-examination for confrontation to be met. So if there is an unavailable witness, and if there's testimonial hearsay, it's very unlikely that the confrontation clause will permit that evidence to be admitted. Now, one of the issues and the final issue on confrontation is that can the party against whom this evidence is offered forfeit his or her right to confront a witness by their wrongdoing? And the United States Supreme Court in Crawford, in a footnote, said yes, they could, but did not in any way define when the wrongdoing of an individual would cause forfeiture of that individual's right to confront witnesses. Giles against California. That was a case in which the defendant was charged with murder of the victim. And before the victim died, the victim made certain statements that were offered as excited utterances. And they were made to police, so they were testimonial. Testimonial hearsay is only admissible if the declarant's unavailable, death is one kind of unavailability, and the declarant has been subject to cross-examination. Well, the declarant hadn't been subject to cross-examination. Why? Because the declarant's dead. Well, therefore, Crawford says not admissible against the defendant. But what the argument was in Giles was that the defendant, by his own wrongdoing, had forfeited his right to object on confrontation grounds. And so the issue that went to the United States Supreme Court in Giles was, when does forfeiture occur? When can an individual forfeit his or her right to confront witnesses against them? And Giles said that there were three requirements for forfeiture. One is that there's wrongdoing by the individual or on behalf of the individual that results in the actual unavailability of the witness. Well, that would clearly be applicable, I would think, to many child abuse situations. However, there is a third requirement for forfeiture, according to the United States Supreme Court, that the individual act with the motive or intent to make the witness unavailable to testify at the trial or hearing. And I would think that it would be a rare case where the act of abuse could be demonstrated to be with the intent of making the child unavailable to testify at the trial of the individual. So I think it is going to be rare that the doctrine of forfeiture, as it applies to confrontation, is going to be applicable in the cases that you are involved in. I covered this pretty quickly. I would be glad to go over any of it in greater detail. I wanted to save time for some questions, so I would welcome any that anybody has about whatever I've covered or about something else as well.
We now have a number of questions, right. So I'll do them in the order they come in. From Lori, thank you so much, Lori. Her question is, how does the unavailability under Crawford, as discussed in State versus Contreras regarding mental or emotional harm, apply?
There's two parts to that unavailability. One is under 803.23. If the victim, for a statement to be admissible in 803.23, a hearsay statement, for example, that tape in Contreras, if the child doesn't testify, the tape would only be admissible if the victim was shown to be unavailable and there was corroboration that the abusive act occurred. All right. The mental harm to the victim, the affirmative showing of the mental harm to the victim, would be sufficient under 803.23. Similarly, under Crawford, at least as interpreted by the Florida Supreme Court, that is a sufficient showing for that same emotional or mental harm is a sufficient showing of unavailability for the purposes of Crawford. Therefore, testimonial hearsay is admissible because the victim is unavailable if the victim has been subject to cross. And I think the problem under Crawford is that it's going to be a rare situation where the child has been subject to cross prior to the hearing.
Okay, Lori, if you have a follow-up to that, feel free to email me back. And in the meantime, I'm going to move on to the next question from Hillary, and she asks if Crawford applies to civil cases.
No. The answer to that is no. And the reason that it was a little bit wishy-washy or uncertain is that I don't know the state of application of Crawford and the proceedings that you appear in. except I've understood just through comments of lawyers involved in this stuff that in termination of parental rights, it does apply. But I don't know any case law that says that. But it clearly, in an ordinary civil case, does not apply. And I think in a shelter hearing, for example, it doesn't apply.
Okay, thank you. And Hillary, if you have a follow up to that, just shoot me an email. I have another question from Frederica, and she asked, does the personal knowledge requirement apply as it relates to getting documents, parentheses, business records, in by declaration or certification?
Well, and what that is referring to is that what Israel, that's Florida Supreme Court case, recognizes is that there are three ways to lay the foundation. One is through the testimony of someone in the business who knows how the business keeps its records and can testify that this is a record made at or near the time of the event and so forth. One is by stipulation that testimony, another is by stipulation that testimony is not necessary, and a third one is by a declaration or certification under 902, I think it's 11, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, so I might be off a little bit on the number, that of the record custodian that this is a record, yeah, it's 902.11, kept in the ordinary course of business and made at or near the time of the event and that sort of thing. And whoever is doing this has to have personal knowledge of the method the business uses in keeping its records. Doesn't have to have personal knowledge of the events recorded in the records.
Okay. And again, Frederick, if you have a follow-up, feel free to email me back. I now have a question actually from Chris. How much flexibility do you think there is on an appellate level for pushing the envelope when it comes to child hearsay and other hearsay in TPR trials? I often argue the statements, whatever they are not being used for the truth of the matter asserted when hearing them can't help but affect the trier of fact.
My view on a number of practice areas. Divorces, probate, eminent domain is based on everything I hear, they've got their own rules. That the rules of evidence are supposed to apply, except nobody applies them. The lawyers don't, and the judges don't. And my sense, just from talking mainly to judges, is that they have varying views on how loosely or how tightly they apply the rules of evidence in the kinds of cases that you are involved in. I think that to argue that it's not hearsay. I mean, I think that can be that's a good argument if in fact there's some reason, legitimate reason for demonstrating that the fact the statement was made has some relevance other than its truth. I don't know enough about the facts in which this might come up to comment on that, but I guess those are my thoughts. So I don't know how much flexibility there is. I would think there's a lot more flexibility in some of these cases than there is in a criminal trial.
Okay, and now I have a question from Hillary, and she is asking, she says, Professor Erhardt has stated that we can argue Rule 12.407, the testimony and attendance of minor child, to make the child unavailable, but aren't dependency cases governed under the juvenile rules, not the family law rules?
I don't have any idea. I mean, that's a good question for you. I've talked to some lawyers who say that this is a problem in cases where sometimes children want to testify, and they're not permitted because of this rule.
Well, and generally, juvenile rules of procedure do control the cases, Hillary. So the family law rule would not be applicable unless...
Okay, good. I learned something.
And anyone else who has a differing opinion, please feel free to email me and I'll convey it.
But. I mean, if somebody wants to let me know, I thought that most of the time, well, I just leave it there.
Okay, I have a follow-up from Frederica, actually. Her initial question, Professor, was about the personal knowledge requirement and business records.
Yeah.
So her follow-up is, so the statements made by the parents and a provider's business record, which the provider is, you know, now that we're privatized, that's the department, basically, but the provider is providing the services, should be admitted even if the records custodian was not the person with knowledge of the statement?
No, I don't think they are, because if I understand it, this is essentially this is DCF under different guys, is that right?
It's DCF, but, you know, they've contracted out all their services, but yeah, they are acting as the department in the case.
All right, I don't think the record custodian does not have to have personal knowledge of the events recorded. In other words, let's go to the hospital. If it's a hospital record, the record custodian has to have personal knowledge of the method in which the hospital keeps its records, but not of the nurse who has noted the vital signs of the patient. Doesn't have to have personal knowledge of that. But the problem is, as in the Reichenberg against Davis case on page 6, an employee of the business, of the hospital, of the provider has to have personal knowledge. And if what you're talking about is statements by the parents, they are not employees of the provider of DCF. And in Reichenberg, essentially says that they're witnesses, and these witness interviews are not admissible as part of the business record or public record exception because no employee of the business had that personal knowledge. And that's what Israel said, that the author, that was the Department of Corrections letter, that the author of the letter had no personal knowledge of what was recorded in the letter. I don't think that you can get in reports of the provider to prove the truth of witness interviews. Now, if you could, now if it, I'm going out of my league here a little bit. But suppose this was a termination of parental rights. What you've got is hearsay within hearsay. You've got the statement, say, of the parent, which is, maybe that's what you're referring to, in the report of the provider. All right, that's hearsay within hearsay. Hearsay within hearsay is admissible if both levels of hearsay qualify under hearsay exception. If it would be a statement of the parent admitting something that would be offered against the parent, then it would be admissible as hearsay within hearsay because a statement of the parent is admissible under 803.18 as a statement of the party opponent. So that hearsay within hearsay, multiple hearsay, can be admissible if both levels of hearsay qualify under a hearsay exception, and that's 90.805. So maybe that's what the question was referring to. But the parent couldn't offer that report to prove the truth of what's in it.
Okay. Thank you. I have more. Let's see. And how much longer do we have you?
For a while.
Okay. We have lots of, this is from one of the chief legal counsels. She gets lots of questions about the admissibility of expert reports when the expert is testifying. Can Professor Arrow talk about overcoming a cumulative evidence objection when trying to both have the expert testify and get the report in? And who is the custodian of the records for the purpose of the report?
Well, the custodian of the record, what 8036 says is that you can establish it, the foundation, through the testimony of the custodian of the record or other qualified witness, which means any witness with knowledge of the way this record is kept. Now, that means that if I wrote the record, I'd have knowledge of the way it was kept. So it's my record of my business, I can lay that foundation. I think that's not a problem. What is a problem is that there are two related issues. The expert witness report is hearsay. The question is it admissible under the business record exception? And there's two general propositions. One of them is that business records generated in anticipation of litigation are not admissible because they lack the necessary reliability. An expert witness report is almost always written in anticipation of litigation. And on page 6, McElroy against Perry is a case which recognizes that and said that a report of an independent medical examiner prepared for purposes of litigation was not admissible under the business record exception. I think in a lot of areas, judges will let those in, however. There's another issue, and that is whether statements of opinion in a business record are admissible. And if you look at 8036, says that records including records of acts, events, opinions, or diagnosis can be admissible. However, under 403, there may be some limit on that, and under the Bradley case, Bradley against Brotman, at least in one case, it was error to admit the record of a non-testifying physician that contained a statement of opinion. That's not really the question. So I think the bigger question is this expert witness report generated in anticipation of litigation? Okay.
Okay. Next, this is from Jennifer. If the child is subject to examination by attorneys of all parties during a videotaped deposition, would that satisfy the requirements for cross-examination when the child is unavailable to testify?
No.
Okay.
Now, because the Florida Supreme Court has said so twice, in the criminal context, it depends on what kind of a videotape it is. If it's a videotape deposition to perpetuate testimony, not a discovery deposition, then I think that the cross-examination would be sufficient. So I'm not sure how this... I think it depends on the nature of the proceeding. Is this truly the same cross-examination that would occur at trial? Not just for discovery.
Okay. Hypo, where the parent tells the substance abuse counselor, I hate my kids. can this statement come in if it is recorded in the business records?
The question is yes. It's going to be offered against the parent, so the business record exception wouldn't be a problem. But the psychotherapist patient privilege and the substance abuse counselor privilege would be the issue there. And whether there is an exception to that privilege, and I'd have to think about that and look a little bit. I'm not sure there is an exception to the privilege that would be applicable. So without doing a little more thought about it, I would say the privilege would apply, but they would be, it would trump the business record exception.
Okay. From Kamisi is asking if you can discuss what constitutes abuse in the presence of the child. Example, case where child is not the victim of physical abuse but is aware that it occurs. Child may not have actually seen it. Would those statements qualify under 803.23?
It's a statement by the victim of the abuse.
No, the child is not a victim of the abuse but knows that it occurs, I guess, to a maybe another
a
parent or to a sibling.
A friend or family member?
Yeah.
Well, it's got to be a victim. 803.23, the out-of-court statement by a child victim. Now, the question, I guess it might be a victim if it was in your presence, but not upon you. But if it's not in your presence, if you just know that a friend or brother or sister, I'm not sure that child would be a victim. But 803.23 says out-of-court statement made by a child victim.
Okay. Could you give some more examples of good and bad corroborative evidence for unavailable witnesses?
Under 803.23.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there's got to be, if there'd be medical evidence that there had been this either physical abuse or sexual abuse. That to me is the best evidence. I think you could have statements. Well, let's see. If there was, I don't think this would happen very often, but statements of witnesses who had seen the act occur. Those are two that come to mind. But the physical evidence from a physician, from a nurse, that either the sexual or physical abuse occurred would be the most likely corroborative evidence.
Okay. From Laura, a therapist asked a child to draw a picture of the family, their family. The picture does not include the child's father, which is relevant because the ground is abandonment. Is this picture hearsay? And she says, I realize it might come in not for the truth of the matter, but as the basis of an opinion if the therapist is an expert.
And it's going to be offered to show that the father has abandoned the family?
Yes.
I don't think it's hearsay then. I mean, I think there's a question. This is a pretty good question. I might ask on my exam. Is this picture an assertion? Is the child intending to assert when the child, a thought or idea, when the child draws this picture? I'm not sure the child is. But if the child is, Is the child intending to assert father is gone? there's no father present. No, I don't think the child's intending to do that at all. If it's an assertion, which I kind of doubt that it is, I think the child is only intending to say, here is my family. So it would not be an assertion that the father was absent. So therefore, it's not hearsay. So I don't think it's hearsay. I don't think it would be hearsay. Now, the rest of that question is that there is a fairly recent case in Florida about experts, Lynn V. Fossum. And Lynn V. Fossum is fairly clear that because because an expert relies on something does not, informing their opinion, does not mean the jury or the finder of fact can see it. It's not admissible because the expert relies on it. That site is 946 Southern 2nd, 1032. 946 Southern 2nd, 1032. An expert can't be used as a conduit for otherwise inadmissible evidence. Again, it sounds like this happens because, like in divorce cases, in probate cases, in eminent domain cases, we do things the way we do them. We're used to doing them. Okay.
Okay. And forgive me, I may have already asked this, but I want to make sure I don't miss anyone's questions, and I've been trying to field the emails and also listen to you, so I'm a little scattered. But
well, that's all right.
If you've already answered, tell me. If a child is scared to testify or does not want to testify, do we need to have an expert say that it would be harmful for the child to testify for purposes of unavailability?
Well, there's got to be some evidentiary foundation that it will be harmful to the child. And therefore, the parents are going to have to testify. Somebody's going to have to testify. Maybe it's an expert. But because you think it or because you know it does not mean that is an adequate showing of unavailability. There's got to be testimony to demonstrate unavailability. So depending on the circumstance, you may need to call an expert.
Okay. Okay, those are all the questions I have. Let's wait one more minute. I sent out an email saying this is the last bit. I want to thank you so much for doing this, and I apologize for that. We had some technical difficulties at the beginning, but it actually ended up being a great and very clear from that point on, so I think we'll get a good recording for the website. And Chris wanted me to especially thank you and tell you that it was great to get an evidence infusion from you again, that you are the best.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Oh, wait, I have one more question actually from Chris.
All right.
So the judge, and I think this is follow-up from that last question, so the judge can't just make a finding of fact that the child will be damaged from the court's own observations?
Well, if it's observations of the child, yes. But not because the judge is a juvenile judge and just knows it. No. There's got to be evidence in the record to support it. And the evidence can come from the judge observing the child. But there's no presumption that the judge can draw. Got to be affirmative evidence.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you again. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you.
And it was great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.